And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
High in the air, Brito back at the wall. Adios, Pelota!
That's the type of manager that I'd like to be, which is the same every day. They know what they're going to get. They're going to get energy. They're going to get accountability. They're going to get structure, and they're going to get support. And I'm going to bring those things to the dugout in the clubhouse regularly.
It takes hard work, and it takes humility, taking one step forward at a time, making one good baseball move after another. And I really feel like that's how we're going to get where we hope and intend to go.
You're listening to Bags and Brisby on Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 189 of the Bags and Brisby podcast. I'm Grant Brisby. I'm here with Andy Baggerlin. Andy, 189 doubles for the 1891 Giants. What are your top five doubles hit by the 1891 Giants?
Well, I would start with the great-great-grandfather of Gene Segura. that is a very inside joke. That's extremely inside joke.
That is a deep cut.
Now I have to explain it. That's the problem with inside jokes. Last year in Philadelphia, Gene Segura hit like his 200th career double, and they like stopped the game. They put him on the scoreboard. He doffed his helmet to the crowd, and all of us in the press box are going like, What's happening here? This is his 200th career double. So, like, Alex Pavlovich, who's just a wonder at social media, like, took the scoreboard and he'll use it in all sorts of different references. He's put Carey Crowley up there. He's done all kinds of things. So, yeah, whenever I think monumental doubles, I think Gene Segura. That's just the way my brain is wired now. But I really don't have a legit answer to your question, although I guess I will have to throw it back to you and ask what your favorite double of the 18-whatever Giants were.
Well, first off, I have to just say, whenever Alex makes that reference, I'm like Lucille Bluth when she sees Gene Parmesan and just like claps and giggles. Every time he makes that joke, it's the funniest freaking thing in the world to me. So the 1890s, that was too early before, like in the 1910s, you would start getting names that are like, you know, Buff Bufferson, or, you know, the funny names are a little bit later. But what I like about the 1890s are that you will have on Baseball Reference names with a question mark after, because they're just not sure. You have Lou Whistler, because they were never able to confirm if his name was actually Lou Whistler. So I don't know. I love going back on Baseball Reference. They did have Jack Glasscock and Dick Buckley. So, you know, it's not a total waste, but we're not here to talk about the 1891 New York Giants. We're here to talk about the 2022 Giants, and they're doing some goofy stuff. It's what was your column like about the seventh inning of that second game in the Mets series? How thick were you going to lay on the doom and or gloom?
Well, we will never know the answer to that question. I will say that I'm really sorry that that those guys in the 1890s with those names had to play without antibiotics. That must have been very rough on them, personally and professionally. What we do in this job is, it's not that we root for the team to win or to lose. We just root for them to not be boring. Just don't be boring. And, you know, if they were going to lose, like they had fallen behind after that Tyler Rogers catastrophe inning against the Mets on Tuesday, I thought, well, at least this one will be an interesting loss. I mean, we can really delve into the lunacy of that inning and get back into a little bit of what you wrote about just that morning, which was, hey, you know, the data says that the Giants should be getting more outs than they actually are. They're doing a lot of things right from a pitching standpoint, and they aren't necessarily being rewarded, and they might be a little bit unlucky. And this was just like, you know, basically, oh, here's Grant the Warlock again, you know, pre-writing exactly what happens. And it happens to Tyler Rogers more than anybody. So I thought, okay, well, at least I can write about that and delve into that. And then, of course, we had more jock and more jock and more jock, and it was one of the greatest Giants games I think I've ever seen, and probably most fans have ever seen. So it will be known as the Jock Peterson game. And so, you know, couldn't really write about Tyler Rogers when it's the Jock Peterson game. But yeah, definitely one of the greatest games I think I've ever seen. And then you get the story from Jock about how he talked to Barry Bonds all the way up until 15 minutes before the game. And wasn't really wearing any pants at that time, so kind of had to get ready really fast. And then he went out and had one of the greatest offensive days by a Giant in history. So that was kind of my journey through that day. What was yours?
It was a very, very strange game to watch on multiple levels. It was hard to necessarily care about baseball. At the same time, it really was like the greatest game I think I've ever seen. The only thing that compared for me was Game 5 of the 2017 World Series. But that, in retrospect, was diminished because the Astros they knew it was coming, which is kind of funny, but it diminishes the actual great baseball. This was just tremendous. I don't know if it's tremendous baseball. It was a lot of baseball. It was just so much baseball. And when I wrote about the pitching maybe not getting as many outs as they should, there's a fine line because I don't just want to say, yep, see, it's bad luck, because that's just so dippy. It's just, it's really, I don't know, it's outdated. We don't know if it's just bad luck. We just have to say, this is weird. Maybe there's a reason. And that night, it just kept happening. It kept happening to Logan Webb. It kept happening to Tyler Rogers times 100. And it was just, it was maddening to watch. But when the Giants came back, it started happening for them too. So I don't know. It's a weird season in a lot of respects, but I just don't know what to make of it. I just am happy to watch that much baseball in a concentrated format because it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and then obviously, Jock Peterson starts against a lefty the next day and hits another home run, and the Giants win pretty easily without any comebacks from the Mets this time. A little more conventional win when you score 9 runs. And they won a series against a team with a winning record, a team that's leading the division, that's a really good baseball team. And entering that series, you know, as we talked about, they were not very good against teams with winning records. So, yeah, I think that was a good series for them on multiple levels. They're going to get some pieces back as they start this road trip. Kurt Casale is probably coming back on Saturday. Jake McGee looks like he's figured some things out. He said he lengthened his stride a little bit. And he's getting more carry with his fastball again, and he's coming back very soon. So, you know, and obviously news is not as good with Lamont Wade Jr., who's now, as Susan Slusser reported, getting regular injections of some sort of synthetic something or other in his knee, which is not good to hear about. Yeah. And he's going to be down for a couple weeks, and they hope they get Brandon Belt back soon. But for now, it's a serious win against a really good team, and didn't necessarily do it in a boring conventional sense, and it was certainly entertaining.
So could Barry Bonds talk to, say, other people on the Giants? I'm fascinated by this story because Jock Peterson was saying, you know, do this with your stance or get a little bit more open. It was more of a mental mindset. And that's fascinating to me because that is the most underrated part of Bonds' game, especially if you weren't watching all of those at bats. When he was up and he would get one pitch to hit a game, the concentration, the focus that it took to be ready for that one pitch, man, I get that he had some better living through chemistry, but that was the really special part about Bonds. How do you convey that to someone else? Did Jock go into details, or was it kept pretty vague?
It was mostly pretty vague, but it was just how to be ready for each pitch and take each moment and separate it from everything that came before or after, good or bad, and just to stay locked in. And he said, you know, there are times he's hit 2 homers in a game and he's come up and had a chance to hit a third, and he's thinking about it. He's thinking about, you know, hitting that third home run, and he gets out of his game, or he swings at a pitch he shouldn't swing at, or he takes a swing on a pitch in a location that he wouldn't have taken if he wasn't trying for a homer, and he, you know, rolls it over and makes an out. And he said this time he just took every pitch independently. And I guess if you can't try to hit your third homer of the game if you're treating it like it's your first at bat of the game, right? So that seemed to be something that clicked with him that he talked about specifically. But you know, he's worked a lot. He's been pretty subdued. I know in the clubhouse he's a different guy, and he's kind of a jokester. You know, Logan Webb called him a clown in the clubhouse, and we know that Brandon Crawford gets along great with him. And but he's, at least when we see him, he's very different. He's very subdued. He's kind of, you might describe him as kind of low energy a little bit. But you know, I think he really has done a lot of work on his mental preparation and what it takes for him to, you know, be as quiet as possible in those moments where he has to focus. And obviously he's been good at it throughout his career. He wouldn't be someone who has been a postseason hero in multiple postseasons without being able to meet those big moments. But it is a skill. It's a special skill. I think it's something that is obviously very, very difficult to quantify, and probably very, very difficult to teach. And Barry Bonds is probably the perfect human being on this planet to help someone like Jock Peterson, who's already good at that, become even better at it.
Yeah, I am fascinated. I mean, we are in teeny tiny samples territory, but he also took two walks yesterday and he did not strike out, which is, I want to see how this focus is, how sticky it is, if going forward, if he's able to just take every pitch in that pitch in the at bat. It's fascinating to me because if you read Eno Saris today, he talks about how there are no more fastball counts. There is no more 3-1, you're sitting dead red and you're ready to go, which almost makes every two-strike pitch the same thing as a first pitch of an at-bat, or every first pitch like a two-strike pitch. I mean, baseball's just different. And so it's going to take that sort of focus for these hitters on every pitch. And I'm just fascinated to see if he can keep it going. And again, I'd like to see Barry Bonds talk to everyone on the Giants.
You know, it's weird to see the intersection with the manager in the other dugout was Buck Showalter, the guy who once intentionally walked Barry Bonds with the bases loaded, right? And then he was yep. the Diamondbacks manager. And they were not touching Jock Peterson on Wednesday. I mean, he was just lightning hot, especially after his first home run. So I don't doubt that some of the walks were the Mets just being extra careful with him. But then he's got to obviously tunnel into his zone and not swing at pitches outside the zone. So yeah, he was definitely a part of that. But I'd imagine that the Mets were probably pitching him as carefully as anyone's ever pitched him on Thursday or on Wednesday.
And so the Giants now, they are, this is a very confusing team, right? Because they are over 500. They have a winning record. They have the same record as the Cardinals. They're doing better than the Orioles and the White Sox, than a lot of these teams that were expected to contend. But it feels like they are almost 500. Is it just me, or do they feel like, I don't know, they're underwhelming, or they are going below expectations? Is it because of the 107 wins? Am I just making this up? It just feels like there's always something for Giants Twitter to grumble about. And I look up and they're second in the world in runs per game. Their pitching does need to allow fewer runs, but you know, the injuries are all over the place, and yet they're still doing pretty good things. I mean, what do you make of this team?
Well, it definitely feels like in the last couple weeks, I think ever since they came back from the road trip that ended in Washington, they've been kind of a two steps forward, two steps back kind of a team. And you know, that they've probably played about 500 baseball since then. So, yeah, they get somebody back off the injured list, and then they go right back on. Or you know, they get the whole team together for one day in Colorado, and then they lose some more pieces. You know, there was definitely a little disjointed period there where, you know, they were giving up two runs and scoring one, or they were, you know, giving up seven runs and scoring six. And it just seemed like they were a little out of sync as a team. And obviously, the defense has not been good. They have not been a very good defensive team at all this year. I don't have, you know, metrics in front of me, but I do have eyes that work. And yeah, they both in the outfield and in the infield, it's been a little bit of a problem. I think Joey Bart has done a good job behind the plate. I really am surprised by just how well he's been able to, you know, keep a good attitude. I know it's been frustrating for him at the plate, but I don't think his defense is part of this at all. I think he's been really, really good. And I think he's called some pretty good pitches and handled the staff fairly well. It seemed like with Kurt Casale behind the plate, the game seems like they're in control a little bit better. With Papierski behind the plate, it seemed like they're getting out of sync pretty fast. And we'll see what happens when Kurt Casale comes off the injured list, probably on Saturday. If they would even consider sending down Joey Bart, I don't think so. But I guess I'm going off on a tangent now, but I think they just sort of seem like a team that hasn't really gotten clicking yet. And maybe this road trip will be an opportunity for them to do that.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
The defense is fascinating because I don't think the Giants are necessarily surprised with the personnel they have. They were never going to have, Dwayne Murphy out there running around and winning gold gloves. They have their best defensive outfielders when they're healthy. You have Mike Yastrzemski, who's probably gold glove caliber in right, a little bit overextended in center. You have Austin Slater, who is very good in a corner, probably overextended in center. And then you have a bunch of guys who are DH adjacent players. And I'm including Luis Gonzalez in that. He has a strong arm, but he is a little bit rough as far as his range and reads and all that good stuff. And I have this wacky theory that with fewer balls going out and a dead ball, that they're just more, the outfielders are expected to do a little bit more. And right now, this outfield just doesn't seem like they are capable of doing a whole lot more. And I don't think every ball is going to be Darren Ruff falling into the stands. That's just that, like, the perfectly placed. But the outfield defense is a concern.
Yeah, I think so. I think it is, especially when you have a staff that, you know, has that puts the ball in play. And, the Giants are really good at ground ball rate. I think it's probably more important that they play tight on the infield. But even someone like Tyro Estrada, I mean, he's made some nice plays. I think you'd say he's an above average defender, but the metrics don't like him. And there are times when he plays a little bit deeper, and you know he needs to take another step or two in. There were a couple balls in the Mets series where, you know, the Giants were coaches were telling him, look, you know, you need to charge that, or you need to play a little bit more in, and. Because a lot of these guys can run and get down the line. So, you know, there's room for improvement pretty much all around the field, I think, defensively. There's this thought within the game that, you know, you can coach up defense. You can coach up people with limited range. But, you know, you got to be sure-handed. You got to make the plays you're supposed to make. And they work a lot on that. They use that little red machine, you know, to get guys to really train their eyes and train their skills to deal with spin and hops and stuff like that. I think that they have a plan and they have processes in place to try to coach up defensive ability. But, you know, when you get down to it, this is not a team that's got a lot of premium defenders. And that's pretty apparent when you watch them.
And it feels like there was a trend not that long ago where everyone was defense, defense, defense. And you had, the rise of Kevin Kiermaier and Kevin Pillar, and you, what you wanted was this ultra rangy center fielder, and every team needed to have one. The Giants don't have that in their system. I mean, the closest they get is Steven Duggar, but he's a pretty solid center fielder, but he's not a gold glove caliber center fielder. Is this a kind of a organizational ethos where they are not going to worry so much about the outfield defense, that they thought that era of baseball was a little bit overrated, and they're almost going back to the Moneyball era where you have Ron Washington saying it's incredibly hard, and you have the GM go, no, it's not that hard. It feels like this is almost a little bit of a throwback to the early sabermetric days.
Yeah, maybe. I think it's probably, for me, I see it as more of a, we're not going to make concessions to our offense to put somebody who's a better defender out there. I mean, we're going to go with the person who is going to be more productive for us offensively. And if they are defensively deficient compared to another option, then we're just going to have to, you know, coach that person up and try to position them better and try to, you know, enhance their skills that they do have to make them better. And You know, I think that defense is just not as much of a priority as what someone can do in the lineup. So, you know, and if you have a player like a Mookie Betts, who's a tremendous defender and also a tremendous offensive player, hey, that's great. You know, get me a whole bunch of those guys. And, you know, but that's why they make, you know, $200, $300 million. And there aren't many of them around the game. And when you can find one, you keep them. So, yeah, you know, the Giants don't really have a lot of players like that. And, you know, they use the collaborative approach. They platoon a lot and, you know, they go for matchups. And I think that's how they put a lineup together on a daily basis. And then defensively, it sort of is what it is.
I will say that the idea makes sense to me that you're going to go for offense first, because in the modern game, you are expecting a strikeout per inning. I mean, the Giants have a slightly below league average strikeout rate as a pitching staff. That's still 8.5 strikeouts per nine innings. So one out every inning is going to be taken care of, where the fielders can, you know, be sitting on their gloves. And so with the Giants going offense first, I think that's very sound. The only problem is when it doesn't work, the optics are just not great. And Darren Ruff not getting that ball when almost any other outfielder would have had that ball, and then he tumbles into the stands. I think he's better than like the worst corner outfielder that you've ever seen. I don't think he is appalling out there, but when it doesn't work and it looks like that, it's such an easy bone to pick with the roster.
You just gave him the worst backhanded compliment in the history of the English language.
Listen,
I don't think he's the worst outfielder I've ever seen. Well, good for you, Darren Goldstar.
Listen, I am a Giants observer and analyst. I have watched Michael Morse and Pat Burrell. I have watched Barry Bonds into his 40s. Friend, I have watched Travis Ishikawa. Like, there is a rich history of people clomping around in left field just in the last, you know, 10, 15 years. So I didn't mean to backhand compliment him that backhandedly, but at the same time, you know what I mean? He's not very good, but he's not the worst.
Aubrey Huff was such a good outfielder that down a chalk line a chalk line in the outfield after he tumbled at Dodger Stadium. So, the Giants have definitely sort of made this sort of devil's bargain a lot with putting someone in left field who's not very good defensively.
It works, I guess, you know?
It really has worked. I mean, you know, when Melky Cabrera was out there, he was pretty good. When Austin Slater's out there, he's pretty good. It's better than pretty good, really good in a corner. And pretty good in center field too, but he's obviously not an option for them right now. And while he's on the injured list with the wrist injury, but yeah, you know, I think that this team probably just has to pitch a little bit better and make the plays that they should make. And you know, that's what they did mostly last year, and they won 107 games doing that. So I think that they still feel pretty good about, you know, hey, look, the catch that we may make that has a catch probability of, you know, 50%, you know, there aren't that many balls that you really do make plays on that an average defender won't make that an above average defender will. So they'll take the marginal gains there and they'll compare it to the marginal gains of having someone who, you know, has an on-base percentage that's, you know, 60 points higher and a slugging percentage that's 40 points higher. And they'll say, give me that. Give me four plate appearances of that. And we'll live with not having the marginal gains on defense. But you got to make the plays you're supposed to make. And that hasn't been happening with a lot of consistency.
Now, you are not in Cincinnati, correct?
I am not. I am not in Cincinnati. I am in Philadelphia. I make all of my road trip decisions based on the culinary value of each city. And so Cincinnati is an easy skip for me.
This is why I was getting into it, because generally Cincinnati is not, you know, for a lot of different reasons. I think it's just it's not a Giants rival. The series generally don't have a ton of importance, but you have made this joke before. And so every year I'm thinking, this is the year I'm going to ask to take your place in Cincinnati, because I really want to try Skyline Chili. And I want to know, have you tried it? And B, what's it like?
So I did try it. I actually did. I tried it, maybe 15 years ago. So I think the problem is it's mislabeled. It's called chili, but it doesn't taste like chili. It tastes more like I don't know.
It's bolognese,
almost like, I mean, it kind of tastes a little bit like mole, you know, mole sauce, where it's got a little cinnamon and a little chocolate in it, except a much worse version of it, because it's also got like like these tiny little beans in it and like meat that looks like it's mechanically separated. And yeah, it kind of looks like vomit, to be honest. So it's just not appealing. It's not appealing. It's not what you're expecting either. I mean, the taste is not as bad as the worst thing I've... It's not the Darren Ruff left fielder of foods, I guess. But I hate to be picking on Darren Ruff here. I'm sorry, Darren, if you're listening. If anybody in the greater Omaha area is listening, I do apologize. But yeah, it's not what you're expecting in a bad way, you know? So... So I just steer clear.
Now, and I'm upset with myself because I really am fascinated by it. And I want to try because I generally like every food. And so I want to be the guy who says it's not that bad or actually I enjoy it. But when I was in St. Louis, I did not try St. Louis style pizza, which I know you're a fan of. And the reason I didn't is because around
in air quotes, I'm a fan of making fun of it.
Yeah, no, it does come up a lot. And I'm fascinated with this, too. And around the corner from my hotel was a place that specialized in St. Louis style pizza. And I didn't go because it got like 2 stars on Yelp. And what I realized when I came home is that they all get 2 stars on Yelp. And I'm really upset that I didn't get to try that. So if you had to choose a meal right now, would it be Skyline Chili or St. Louis style pizza?
I would just go for the toasted raviolis. Can I go off the board? They're not bad. They're okay. They're kind of like Totino's pizza rolls with like an extra like layer of deep fried whatever around it. So yeah, they're not bad. I'll just go off the board and say toasted raviolis.
All right, that's fair. Those are good. All right, but before we go, I did want to. This is changing gears in a very unsubtle way, but I did want to talk to you about your Logan Webb article because it was fantastic, and it was really richly reported, and it was heartbreaking, and it really stunned me because when I hear a drug overdose, your mind is like, my mind at least is stuck in the 80s where you, or the 90s or just in the past where drug overdoses mean a very specific thing and they happen to very specific people. And that was one of the most important parts about your article is that, no, this is different. This is a different kind of reality that people are facing right now.
Yeah, no, thanks. And it is a tough thing to segue to. I mean, that whole day, Tuesday, and obviously it ended with one of the greatest Giants games we've ever seen. But I mean, what an awful day, you know. Yeah. I'd been working on this story for about 2 months. You know, obviously it's something that affected me mentally working on it and kind of absorbing the pain of interviewing people and asking them to relive the worst day of their life. Then, you know, I can only imagine what it was like to actually experience it firsthand. So, you know, it was, I was just really relieved that, you know, finally was finished and that we finally, put it out there. And then obviously what happened in Texas happened, and you know, it's hard. It's hard to live in this world right now and be filled with optimism or hope sometimes. And, find a resolve to change the things that you don't agree with or make a difference. And I think I had heard about what happened because I know some people out in that area. And, I had just mentioned it to Logan after I had an interview with him in spring training and just said, you know, hey, I did hear about what happened with your cousin. I just wanted to send my condolences to you. And he immediately was like, you know, we got to do something. This has to change. This is out of control. And I said, well, I do happen to be a sports writer. We can write a story on it if you want. And his family was all on board. And I talked to so many people in his family, a really, really strong, really close family. And, you know, it's someone in the comments of the story made a good point. They said, you know what, it doesn't matter what kind of background someone has who dies of a drug overdose or fentanyl poisoning. They're all worthy of our understanding and our empathy. And I totally agree with that. But I do think that there does have to be some understanding of what's happening here because it's very easy for us to just go mentally shortcut to, oh, overdose, irresponsible, despondent, had nothing to live for, you know. But that's just not the case. The kid had just bought a new sport coat to wear to his cousin's wedding. It was literally in 48 hours. He was super excited for it. He was playing golf the next day. He was going to have his first baby girl in a month. And And, you know, I'm dealing with a lot of the stresses of life, and how are you going to provide for this kid who's on the way? And, you know, he was looking just to medicate some anxiety there, and thought he was taking a Percocet and ended up having fentanyl in it because it was a counterfeit pill, and you know, he dies in the bathroom of a grocery store. It's awful, you know. And this family has a hole in it now that won't ever be filled. And there's way, way too many families out there who are dealing with something similar. And, you know, I think it's one of those deals where it's so easy just to default to statistics. And, well, it's a statistic, and you don't get emotionally involved. You don't really absorb what's happening. And so, you know, I thought it was probably important that, you know, I try to give you a picture of just who this kid was and what his life was like and what he meant to people. And then you understand what the loss is. You understand that this is the loss of a person who meant a lot to the people who loved him, and they don't have him in their lives anymore. There's a little girl who will never know her father, and it's heartbreaking. But I think that unless we really sort of empathize with people on a personal level who have experienced this, then, you know, it's hard to really call for change until you can really, I guess, connect with it on a personal level. And you know, in terms of what happens to us, in terms of the politics, in terms of the legal system, in terms of, you know, there are people in the comments who are just like, see, this is why we can't have open borders. It's like, you know, there are a lot of ways you can be super reductive and say, well, here I am, I've got the solution to this. It's just, you know, vote for these politicians or have these policies. It's like, no, this is systemic on a whole deeper level. And it's something that it starts with awareness and you know, knowing what your risks are, because it's you know, there are a lot of recreational drug users out there who are, you know, dropping dead and they don't, I mean, that's why I don't call it an overdose, because they never sign up for a dose of fentanyl in any amount. They think they're taking something that's, you know, not dangerous, and they're dying, and it's, you know, it's something that ripped this family apart. So, you know, I really just appreciate the Logan Webb wanting to make a change, and his family for just being super, super brave and just pouring out so much of their raw emotion, because a story like this doesn't happen without that.
And it is the awareness that, for me, is, I mean, it's why they wanted to do it, but it's something that I wasn't expecting to have so many takeaways from it that I needed. I would like to think of myself as, oh, wizened, and, you know, I had my younger days, wink, wink. No, this is nothing that I experienced when I was, you know, when I was doing recreational things. It was, oh man, what if this is laced with something that makes you feel different, or what if this is that and you have a bad trip? You know, like, that sort of stuff was the fear. It was never, whoops, and you get one mistake. You don't get, it's one strike and you're out. It is just, it's a kind of, and I don't think a lot of people know that. It's just so different from anything that I've experienced. And if I think that I'm experienced, no, this is a very different. So Logan Webb's cousin, Cade, he was not despondent, like you're saying. He was looking for just a little bit of to take the edge off, or whatever you're doing as a recreational drug user. And it should not be. These consequences are outsized, and they're not anything that I had to deal with, or most of us had to deal with. So awareness is the key here.
Yeah. And, you know, the one analogy that we sort of came up with together, Kurt Webb, Cade's father, and I were just sort of talking, and it occurred to me, I said, you know, it's almost like you're going to have people out there who are going to blame drug users and say, well, you know, if you didn't want to drown, you shouldn't get in the water. Right. And I mean, that's true on some level, on a basic level. But, you know, imagine you're in the water and you're in a protected bay and you're splashing around with your friends and you have no, you have a reasonable assumption of safety, and then a tsunami hits you, a freak thing hits you, and you never saw it coming. And that's kind of what fentanyl is. It's just, there's no, you just got to be aware, you know, that this is a danger that didn't exist before that exists now. And I guess it starts with awareness, and hopefully, you know, some people read the story and that awareness helps to maybe save a life or two.
Thank you for writing it. It was a tremendous story. I encourage everyone to go and read it if you haven't already. We are out of time. So this has been episode 189 of the Bags and Brisby podcast. Thank you so much for listening. So we will be back next Thursday. So a week's worth of baseball. We'll figure out what happened and see you then.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.